If we permit others to love us, then they make claims on our lives. In response, we belong to them. We know then that it is difficult, a difficult thing to be loved. In response, help us, Lord, to be loved as well as to love. When we want to be free, those who love us tie us down, for such is the depth of love. When we want to think of ourselves as being inadequate, those who love us make us feel greater than we are prepared to feel, for such is the depth of love. When we want to be hard-nosed or angry, those who love us appeal to our sensitivity and ask us to be gentle, for such is the depth of love. When we feel moody, those who love us ask us to come and play with them in the land. To be loved means to belong to others. Teach us the mystery of being loved, O God, and help us to believe that those who say they love us really do, and allow us to believe that their love for us is real. In response, keep us from exploiting and manipulating each other out of the fear that we are not worthy of true love. In the bleakness of February, we celebrate a day of love. Make each day in our lives a day of good news. In response, the good news is the love of Jesus Christ. That's a nice part. In preparation, in not preparing for this, last night I was reading something and it reminded me pretty strongly how dangerous it is for a male to be talking about intimacy, because we are not the ones who have been very good at it. That's why I believe the church, Marty says, the church has been wrong about sex and women throughout the centuries. And what I would add to that, and that's because it's been male dominated. I think that's quite accurate. So I was reading something about Betty Davey, dear friend of mine. I tried to think of her name earlier this week and I couldn't. I came back and here's an article by her, in which she talks about the inadequacy of a theology that is not developed also by women, and how badly that is. And certainly to talk about intimacy from the point of view of one white male is wholly inadequate. So I'll be sharing that perspective, but I realize this is really has to be conditioned by lots of other stuff, including much perspective from women. That is not to say that intimacy is exclusively the province of women or the province of two people of the opposite sex. It is not to say that. But I think in this whole of this society, to understand intimacy, we need input from many people. It's a neat article by Betty, by the way, just entitled A Whole Theology. So that's my caveat, okay? A quote. From Thoreau. I lose my respect for the person who can laugh at the subject of sex and sexuality. Yet when one speaks earnestly and seriously on the subject, is silent. I agree. In other words, a good deal of our humor. I almost appeared on the Johnny Carson show once. I was interviewed. And I was going to talk about double entendres, because I think that a whole lot of our stuff reveal a lot about ourselves by the way we use humor, especially sexual humor. I had just written a book called Life Can Be Sexual, and that's why I was going to be on. And Johnny went out of town for some other reason, and I didn't get on. But I think that our humor does reveal it, and a lot of our humor is sexual humor. And I think that's, not much of the time, of course it is abused, but much of the time I think that's healthy. But if we only have humor and don't have, you know, the ability to be serious about it, I agree with Thoreau. And another quote, I don't know who said this, sometimes I find myself quoted in an unfortunate way, and when I check, it's exactly what I said. So I add that to what it's about. Well, this won't be that well organized because I'm pulling it from a couple of places. But let me tell you some feelings and thoughts that I've had about this and see if it pushes you in any direction. And then I would hope that we could have some discussion about it and sharing. I don't know if you help anything when people say, well, we ought to define terms. I think that often cuts all the edges off because that's usually an intellectual process. But I'm going to start with that anyway, and that this is that really underscores the inadequacy, I think, of definitions for me. When I talk about intimacy, I'm talking about the mutuality of confession of our whole, of our total self to another. How we let ourselves, as fully as we are able, to be known by another. I think there is intimacy with things as well as with people. And we're committed to thinking about it in relationship with people. There are intimate places. Can you think of intimate places that you know? Mm-hmm. For instance, you want to share, anybody? Don't have to.
For me, lots of walks.
I think you're in. I have a number of intimate places around here for me. Some unique church settings for me because of my profession. There are some that are very intimate for me too. And I think some of Nancy's slides and other people. I must forget who the people are. Took all the good slides of flowers, for instance. I feel an intimacy with some flowers in some of those slides. There's something that connects me that gets close to this. But this is a definition that deals mostly with human beings. In which my strength is your strength, and your pain is my pain, and your weakness is my weakness. And so often, intimacy plays a very strong role in relationship to weakness. It's often in the deep fellowship of the weak intimacy is born. And I think that for everyone, because being on a continuum of weak and strong is just a reminder, it's all on a continuum. When Ginny and I were in therapy, she was in therapy on one end of the continuum, which was what our therapist called a primary relationship, PRT therapy. That meant she had missed a primary relationship in her early years, a significant one. She thought it was her dad, and she found out it really was her mother. And I was at the other end of that, which was what he called a super baby, meaning you were super, treated superly as a baby. And it was good to be whoever I was. So if something went wrong, Ginny would say, gosh, what did I do now? And the super baby would say, well, gee, if they really knew me, they'd understand that it was really going to be okay. But both were afraid to be discovered on that continuum. There's really no difference between those human beings, except they're playing the role of a game of life in different ways. But both of them are afraid. I use five ways of talking about kinds of intimacy or ingredients of intimacy. Mutuality, trust, openness, risk, and gentleness. And again, these sound like products or something you mix in or something like that, but they really are meant to say much more than that. I think the one very frequently missing, at least in times past, and this is what I think partly is what the feminist movement is helping us change, is the mutuality, is that we tend to be, we're brought into the world by something, somebody's carrying us right off the bat. And then we're taken care of, and it's you know, like this, and then we have a teacher, and it's a lot of this kind of stuff. And when we finally move towards a friend, a playmate, or something like that, then it gets like this, and then we get in fights, and it goes anyway. Mutuality for me is when two people are coming here, and they're never perfectly even. Like when I'm sick, my wife always said I enjoy ill health. I love being taken care of. And so this is a good relationship. You better believe it. It's a good relationship. But it isn't mutuality or it isn't intimacy, because that's when we both, when each sees in the other something wholly desirable. And that that is seen. I'm impressed, I'm attracted, I'm intrigued by the other. And the other is some way, maybe for many different reasons, quite different reasons, intrigued by me. The mutuality comes. To be dependent on one another, to be carried. I don't think you can carry a friend very long. That's a good relationship, but it isn't a friendship. It's a dependency. And dependencies give back and forth. I believe that too. So I think mutuality is a critical point. Trust is another difficult. That's what we spend all the time, I think, in the intimate relationships at, is learning what it means to trust. When I trusted my wife, and that doesn't mean that she wasn't trustworthy, it just means I think it's terribly difficult to trust another human being. When I trusted Jenny, to me that meant that whatever happened, whether between us, whether I liked it or not, or whether I knew it or not, in advance of its happening, I believed that it was for our well-being and my well-being. And that's pretty tough. I think that's extremely tough to do that. Because if Ginny did something I didn't like, my normal reaction was, you know, not to trust. And trusting, it seems to me, is assuming in advance that no matter what it is, even if it's something I really am bugged by, it still is for our well-being. Doesn't mean it turns out that way, but it's the trust is that assumption. The trust is, is a feeling. You don't decide to trust somebody. You have to experience it. That's what takes time in relationships, is having enough experience so that trust, what, makes some sense or has been validated or something like that. We can, so that's the time I think this problem comes in. And that's why Jen and I learned to trust each other along, because we had a lot of time, 35 and a half years. Good part of which weren't very trusting. Because of me, because I was so dumb about relationships. My story is I graduated from the seminary knowing everything about God, but nothing about human beings, starting with myself. And therefore, nothing about God. It's impossible to know about God if you don't know about yourself. And so I had a long post-seminary theological training by my wife. It taught me how to know human beings, including myself. The third part was openness, or honesty. Now that's a behavior, and you can decide to do that. You can decide to be as honest and open as you want to be, or you're able to be at the moment. And that means letting people see you as you are, warts and all. And what's more difficult, in my opinion, being willing to see another person as he or she is, warts and all. And I think there are probably more friendships thwarted or intimacy not achieved because of our fear of knowing another person than the fear of letting other people know us. Now, that's not the popular psychological perspective at the moment, but I still think that may be more true. Because if you receive that from another person, that knowing in depth, as this prayer said, you're committed. You're carrying something that you've entrusted. And that's not easy. And a lot of time we doubt, I think. I think there's been changes in that too. Another dimension of intimacy for me is the risk. The risk to even reach out to another person. My daughter told me, I think this is fair to say, to think that through. Yeah. She asked a man for a date recently, first time ever. And how difficult it was. She had some good encouragement from Barbara and Linda Gamrath, so that was good help. But what she went through in that risk, because the risk was, you might say no, which is, you know, symbolic about a lot of our reaching out to other people. So that's a part of the risk. Another part of the risk is for me to know how much of myself I give at what point to another person. If Heidi and I are going to be friends, we're going to be intimate, I can give all of me to Heidi, then there's no me left, you know. And then it's a Heidi kind of relationship and not a Heidi Elmer. Or vice versa. Or how much at a given time that Heidi can take of me, or how much I can take of Heidi, does that change? We're making those decisions all the time in a relationship that we're working on. So it's that risk of knowing what to give and what not to give and how to. Not to just sit down and figure it out and print it, but I think that's what's going on some of the time. And a third dimension of the risk, and maybe you can think of others, is to know that you, that no human being possesses another human being. We do not possess our children. Therapists stay in business for a long time because some of us at least think we possess our children, that they belong to us. They move to another part of the country or something, we think they've abandoned us. It's really bad thinking. And especially then in an intimate relationship, the toughest thing for me to say when Jenny was alive was to say that if I loved her enough and she needed or wanted not to be with me, that I would be able to let her go. And my stomach would churn as I said that. And I don't want to let her go. But the borderline of possessiveness is one of the risks. It's easy to slip into. We belong to each other, and I can control you, make you do my will or whatever. And the last one for me is gentleness. Not namby-pamby, but the gentleness that is born, I believe, most of the time of strength. I think it's true to say that most of the time, at least, only the strong can afford to be gentle. And if in our society, as I believe, the women in general, are better at expressing gentleness than men are. And if it is the strong that can be gentle, then we know who the strong are in this society. And what's implied by that is that men have to be willing to learn gentleness from women. Express it at least. And the women, pray God, have to be willing to teach what it means to be gentle. Let me say one other thing and then I'll save what I'm going to say there. In his book, I Believe in the Resurrection of the Body, I referred to this the other day, Reuben always talks about longing remembrance. And he talks about God dwelling in longing remembrance. This has a lot of appeal to me because of Jimmy's death. It deals with absence and love. And then he talks about that's the relationship we have with God. But even when longing remembrance is being with one another, or being separated from one another by 30 yards or 300 miles or whatever it is, there's a real strong connection, it seems to me, to that. And that longing remembrance that you do remember that person. It has to deal with your whole of you, remember your whole of your body, not just a mind or a mental or a word or even a place, but that wholeness of the other person. And then there's a longing for that person. And of course, always goes on to say that's what we do in the sacrament. We are longingly remembering Jesus Christ and uses that as an illustration for what it means to be intimate and to be intimate with God. I have stuff in here too that deals with what I think is the revelation of God's longing for intimacy with us. I'm the vine, you are the branches. Or whoever comes to me dwells in me, and my Father and I dwell in that person. There's a very strong element of intimacy in the whole relationship with God. I think that's why we can be intimate with nature as well, as an expression of God. That intimacy gets shot down. I don't know whether the Trinity, this menage a trois, that keeps us from being intimate. I think we usually think of it as one-on-one. And God comes to us in three persons, and it all gets messed up. I don't hear much intimacy. I don't mean the word so much, but hear much intimacy from the church. And it ought to be a specialist, it seems to be, in intimacy. With the communion of saints. Well, we talk about the word communion is a word for intimacy. But we don't use it that way. We use it more in a realm of fellowship, which I think, I see individuals. In communion, I see emerging, coming together. A quote, where did I see it? Oh dear. Can't remember where I read it. Well, just the power to give yourself to another person in such a full way that unique mystery of intimacy takes place, and yet not lose yourself. It is not the disappearance of self. As I was saying before, in this relationship, if there's no Elmer and no Heidi, there's no intimacy. We both remain, and yet there is something else in the relationship. Pam Burdick is here in the village. This is going to help me, I think, pick up my word processor, because I want to get back at writing a book, and the book that I'm interested in writing is Predictable Crisis and Intimacies. And that has to do with recognizing that it's possible. When people have studied a lot of relationships, they've studied the developmental process of the woman, it's usually been male, female, and the developmental process of the man, and say, well, now see, that's the problem is here. And my contention is that the relationship also has its own existence and is a developmental process. And I'd like to play with that and see how it connects the other way around. So intimacy in itself, it seems to me, has a reality that is its own. There's something by a fellow named Eugene Peterson. This world is no friend to grace, he says. Seeking for intimacy at any level, with God or with persons, is not a venture that gets support of many people. Intimacy is not good for business. It is inefficient. It lacks glamour. If love of God can be reduced to a ritualized hour of worship, if love of another can be reduced to an act of sexual intercourse, then routines are simple and the world can be run efficiently. But if we will not settle for the reduction of love to lust and of faith to ritual, and we run through the streets asking for more, we will most certainly disturb the peace, behold, and be told to behave ourselves and go back to the homes and churches where we belong. If we refuse to join the cult of exhibitionists who do a soul striptease on cue, or the flashers who expose their psychic nudity as a diversion from long-term covenantal intimacy, we are dismissed as hopeless Puritans. Intimacy is no easy achievement. There's pain, longing, disappointment, and hurt. But if the costs are considerable, the rewards are magnificent. For in relationship with another and with God, the God who loves us, we complete the humanity for which we were made. We stutter and stumble, wander and digress, delay and procrastinate. But we do learn to love, even as we are loved, steadily and eternally, in Jesus Christ. That's why I think the Eucharist is a divine intimacy, that communion that takes place. One of the reasons that Ginny and I joined a church in the city, 27 miles away, one way, was our experience of the Eucharist at that church. It's a 98% black church, but the intimacy that we discovered there, even the expressions of it on the first time that we were there, pulled us back. And the solo voice of a black woman singing at Ginny's memorial service was a moment of profound intimacy. But she sang for that congregation. My therapist, just a number of years ago, I don't know what he would say today, but he can't say that he died. Walked out on us, and I was still pretty angry about it. I haven't dealt with that death, by the way, very well. I walked past in Chicago. I'll be in Chicago next month again, and I walked by Madison in Michigan, where his office used to be, and I sort of shudder and shake yet. I haven't dealt with his death. Quickly, he did a session on Friday night, and Saturday morning he was gone. So I don't know what he would say today. But at that time, he talked about what he thought people were looking for in intimacy. And he thought at that time it was different for women and men. And that maybe understanding that would help intimacy. He thought that women wanted in an intimate relationship to be the primary person. Number one in the life of the other. Secondly, that she wanted to be treated as whole, a whole human being, not simply a body, or not simply whatever else it may be, but full, body, mind, spirit, whatever you want to use it, but a whole person. And thirdly, woman, he thought, sought interdependence, or to say it negatively, not to be controlled. And for men, he thought that the man sought in intimate relationships to be significant in the life of the other. Not necessarily number one, because the male in the society still gets a lot of feedback, positive, and everything else in other ways. And he wasn't affirming that as a good thing, but he was saying he thought it was different. And secondly, that the man wanted his perception of maleness affirmed, whatever that maleness may be. It might have been physical strength, it might have been a good body, it might have been sexual prowess, might have been size of the penis, or whatever it may be. The man wanted that maleness affirmed. And thirdly, he wanted interdependence, or to say it negatively, not to be controlled. What the therapist told us is that every time you have a good fight, and he thought good fights were very important to any relationship, if you look back, you probably were fighting about one of these six things. Ginny and I fought in good fights. I don't mean pleasant fights, I mean good fights. In fact, those are some of the things I remember the best. We almost exclusively fought about the third one. One or the other of us felt we were being controlled, or somebody was trying to control us. Well, I think I'll just stop there. There's lots more to be said. And ask if you want to comment anywhere. And one of the questions that I have, or two questions that I have. What do you think people are looking for in intimate relationships? And then if you want to be more bold, what are you looking for in an intimate relationship? You can start anywhere or respond in any way.
I wonder what, you know, that was the therapist's projection of what a woman would want. Mm-hmm. And I wonder how many women that is really important to be number one, or if it's the same thing of just being significant. Because I guess I personally don't hold that.
Yeah, he said, I think that is changing. But most of the women that he had in therapy clearly were there. But he thought clearly also that was changing. That the feminist women in particular, was an enabler. Yeah, he felt those were acculturated. He didn't think those were the ideals by any means. That they should be that way. Because I don't know that he would have affirmed the males. And then I said, well, no, that can't possibly be so, because people are all different. Can't possibly have any predictable thoughts. Then I said, no, that's too easy now. You know, just generalize and say it can't happen. So I'm suspicious in my own self that maybe there are more things alike, even with all those differences, than we would suspect. I don't have any evidence, I'm not at least. But I spent about 2 weeks at the Library of Congress, and I found some research that was pretty close to that. But that's affirming what you're saying, and then raising a little question mark about it.
Experience and your reading regarding that predictable crisis in the relationship that really intrigues me. Does that mean knowing kind of the pattern before a predictable crisis, does that mean that certain things could be done in that relationship to prevent that predictable crisis? Or if a couple is going to grow, do they really need those predictable crises to enter into deeper intimacy?
The audience for the book, if there's a book there, would be people who had experienced it. Because I think beforehand they wouldn't understand what you're talking about. But that after, I spent a good deal of my time, maybe 80% of my time with divorced people at the university for 12 years. And almost all of my counseling had to do with entering a divorce, going through a divorce, or ending a divorce, whatever. And there are still so many of those people that they, I think, could go back. Some could go back and see that and say, yeah, that made sense. Or this didn't, but this did. And maybe that could adjust some behavior, or bring some understanding. Again, most of those crises are deeply emotional ones. And so whatever the relationship is between the intellect, the perception, and the feeling part, that would be tough to predict whether it'd be helpful or not. But I think just the fact that there are a lot of generalities about such things that are probably not true, but it'd be good to uncover some of those as well. Because we are living with attitudes towards such crises. For some, this crisis means the end of a relationship. For other people, it's just ordinary. And another person, the other thing, means the end of a relationship. A lot of them connected with the death of a child, with the death of a parent, with a new job, with at our university, with women seeking jobs who've had children, two or three children, then coming to finish your education and getting a job. So a lot of external things that affect it as well. Anybody else?
doesn't have to be between people, but
sure.
I like what you said about the Trinity and being close to God. And
mm-hmm.
You know, half the time I suppose people don't know if they're not, are they walking with Jesus or walking with God or the Holy Spirit or who they're praying to.
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes when you read the Old Testament, you almost kind of envy them because it was
yeah.
God and them.
Yeah.
At the time, no, well, yeah.
Yeah.
That, that's a good point. I hope we made that so complicated. Or
yeah, I don't know. Well, we still are operating with a personhood for God, and that probably is the one that works for most of us. But I certainly don't think that it's. The only way to think about God, both the Old and New Testament, deal with the relationship in terms of that. But what if it's the relationship to life force? What if the next incarnation is done through microbiology or some other kind of thing? There could be a whole different way of whatever we call the God relationship happening. And I'm comfortable with the person one because it's, you know, a major part of my experience is my relationship with my wife and with my five kids, as well as with friends. So that's a pretty strong dimension. But I'm not sure that's the only way that can be sensed or talked about or experienced or shared. So I'm more comfortable with moving in that area maybe than something. Healy's article talks about the importance of anger and the negative dimensions of that of intimate relationships. In one sense, the suffering, you know, that we carry pain, our own pain and others' pain, maybe world pain or whatever it may be, that's all part of it as well. But then also the possibility not only of exuberant and celebrative response, but also the responses of the negative responses of these would call me, that would include anger. And their contention would be that women's anger, women can be angry at things out there, they can't be angry either at themselves or other art men. And that's been a thwarting of human relationships to not be able to express that. That's one aspect of it.
How does she feel that women can be angry at men?
Well, she thinks that generally that's been, that the history has been that that's not allowed.
The answer is I'm asking the question.
You know that most questions are a form of statement. No, I think we also, I'd say, you know, in a deep and trusting relationship, we also trust when things go wrong, when there is really a hindrance in the relationship, too. The trust gets tested at that time. But yeah, now we're talking about this idealizing, there is this trust. Well, that's why I said, when I trusted Jenny, I certainly did not trust her all the time. I would sure trust her with a car, but I wouldn't trust her to get where she was going. She had her good record of getting lost. But, you know, that's a small part, but I think that is a difficult. And I think that's why the communication stuff and the honesty part of this is such an important part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And the risk. Because if there isn't a risk, there isn't a chance for being abused.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's what. When we want to be free, the thing says, you know, they're going to tie us down. It's going to be, that risk is part of exposing yourself to another person.
I guess what I'm really struggling inside with is that blind trust. I mean, I really like that assumption, but the thing I've been really struggling with, the issue of child abuse and spouse abuse, of a person really, really trusting that other to the point where they're willing and subject themselves to victimization.
That might be different. That might be wanting to be controlled. that, I think that'd be different than trusting.
I don't think that I get, there's a touch of anger there, because women who I've dealt with that are abused, it's, I don't see inside them a deep thing that they want to be controlled. They don't want that abuse.
No, I would not. I would absolutize any one of those. I mean, that's the danger both in relationships and in religion. But as soon as we say something, we want to absolutize. I couldn't absolutize mutuality, because I'd rule out all the relationships after a while. You know, somebody's dying. It's no longer mutual. You know, get up and do something for me. Or it's gone. It's changed. So I couldn't absolutize. And blind trust for me would be an absolutizing of an ingredient that I think is important. There are some times when honesty is much more important than trust. And there's another time when mutuality is more important than gentleness or whatever it may be. So I'm sure would agree with you. And I think any good thing is the most subject to abuse. This is what we say, love. You can love your children to death. You can love your spouse so much, for instance, or your friend or whatever it may be, that you wouldn't see the evil.
For me, when I think of the very essence of the meaning of trust, that when there has been control, trust has been destroyed. Mm-hmm. Not only in relationships, but in my faith toward God. I often simply tell myself I either trust God or I be God. Mm-hmm. Something I learned from my chemical dependency friend.
Sure. You know,
and that's true both as I think of God and my relationships with others.
Yeah, I think that's the risk of any relationship, is that it can be abused, and that abuse, as you say, can have all kinds of spin-offs to the whole of life. And by the same token, the renewal of trust and intimacy can be a renewal of life.
I think on that trust issue, you have to take the responsibility for taking care of yourself. For example, Jenny getting lost. Mm-hmm. I'm thinking like, well, what would she have done if you weren't there? She would take that responsibility on herself, so she was not trusting herself that she could do that. She was allowing you to be
the same. And it was okay for her to be lost. She was lost regularly. She enjoyed it. We were driving down the interstate once, and all of a sudden she woke me up. She says, I got off the interstate. I don't know how. She put off on some road.